This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This recording is by Mark Smith of Simpsonville, South Carolina. The Swiss Family Robinson by Johann David Wyss. Chapter 44. The next day the weather was delightful. We rose before daybreak. My eldest sons took their work tools, which we might want, and their guns also, but under the condition that they should not use them till I gave the word fire. I carried the bag of provisions. Our flock of sheep had increased so much at the farm that we allowed ourselves to kill one, and my wife had roasted a piece for us the preceding evening. To this we added a cake of cassava, and for our dessert we depended on the fruits of the trees we might discover. But, previous to our departure, while I was taking leave of my wife and Francis, I heard a dispute in the colonnade, which I hastened to learn the cause of. I found it was a question between Fritz and Jack whether we should make the tour of the island by sea or land, and each was anxious for my support. Fritz complained that, since their two expeditions in the canoe, Jack believed himself the first sailor in the world, and that they had given him the name of Lord of the Waves, because he was constantly saying, "When I was under the waves, when the waves were washing over me, do you think that they left me dry?" "No, Mr. Sportsman," said Jack, "you have got enough of them, and that's the reason you don't wish to try them again. For my part, I love the waves, and I sing, 'The sea, the sea, it was the sea that brought us here.'" "What a boaster you are," said Fritz. "It was only yesterday you said to me, 'I will guide you, I know the way by the rocks. I got my buffalo there, and I intend to have another.' Was it in the pinnace you intended to pass the defile and pursue buffaloes?" "No, no, I met on foot," said Jack. "But I thought we should be only two then. Now, as we are four, Papa at the helm and three bold rowers, why should we fatigue ourselves in making the tour of the island on our legs when we have a good vessel to carry us? What says Mr. Philosopher, the Prince of Idlers, to it?" "For my part," said Ernest quietly, "I'm quite indifferent whether I use my legs in walking or my arms in rowing. It is equally fatiguing. But walking gives me more chance of filling my plant box and my game bag." "And does he think," added Fritz, "that the mulberry and breadfruit trees, which we shall certainly find on the other side, grow on the sea, without naming my gazelle, which does not run over the waves?" "No, it is waiting, without moving, for you to shoot it," said Jack. "And, Ernest, perhaps you may find on the sea some of those curious things, half plants, half animals, which you were showing me in a book." "The zoophytes, or polypi, for they are of the same family, though there are more than 1,000 species," said Ernest, charmed to display his knowledge. But I stopped him by saying, "We will dispense with 1,000 names at present. After hearing all your arguments, attend to mine. Even Jack must yield to them. Our principal aim now being to search for the trees we are in need of, and to examine the productions of the island, our most sensible plan will be to walk." Jack still contended that we might land occasionally, but I showed him the danger of this, the island being in all probability surrounded by reefs, which might extend so far into the sea as to take us out of the sight of the island. This I intended to ascertain some day, and in the meantime I proposed to them that we should endeavor to find a pass round the rocks on our side, from whence we could walk to the defile at the other end, take our canoe, which we had left at anchor near the great bay, and return to Tent House. Jack was in ecstasies. He declared the pass must be very well concealed that escaped his search, and, seizing his lasso and his bow, rushed out the first, singing, "The sea, the sea!" "There goes a sailor form my nature," thought I, as we followed the course of the chain of rocks to the left of our dwelling. It conducted us first to the place of our landing, that little uncultivated plain of triangular form, of which the base was washed by the sea, and the point was lost among the rocks. I found here some traces of our first establishment, but how wretched all appeared, compared with our present comforts. We tried here in vain to find a passage to cross the rocks. The chain was everywhere like an impenetrable wall. We arrived at the ravine Fritz and Ernest had scaled, when they had discovered their grotto, and truly nothing but the courage and rashness of youth could have undertaken this enterprise, and continued it daily for 3 weeks. It appeared to me almost impossible. Fritz offered to ascend, to show me how they had accomplished it, but I would not consent, as it could serve no useful purpose. I thought it better for us to proceed to the border of the island, where it was not impossible that there might be a small space on the strand between the rocks and the sea, round which we could pass. From my son's being able to distinguish from the summit the country on the other side, it was evident the chain of rocks could not be very broad. Suddenly Fritz struck his forehead, and seizing Ernest by the arm, "Brother," said he, "what fools we have been!" Ernest inquired what folly they had been guilty of. "Why did we not," said Fritz, "when we were working within our grotto, attempt to make the opening on the other side? We should not have had much difficulty, I am persuaded, and if our tools had not been sufficient, a little powder would have opened us a door on the other side. Only consider, father, the convenience of bringing the cart loaded with the trees we wanted through our grotto, and to be able to go a-hunting without having I don't know how many miles to go." "Well, we can still do that," said Ernest, in his usual calm, grave manner. "If we do not find another passage, we will make one through the grotto Ernestine, with Mama's permission, as it is her property." This idea of my son appeared good. It was quite certain from our experience at Tent House and in the grotto that the cavity in the rocks was of very great extent, and it did not appear difficult to pierce through to the other side. But some other chain of rocks, some gigantic tree, some hill at the end of our tunnel, might render all our labor useless. I proposed that we should defer our work till we had examined the nature of the ground on the other side. My sons agreed, and we proceeded with renewed courage, when we were suddenly checked by the side of the sea beating against a perpendicular rock of terrific height, which terminated our island on this side, and did not give us a chance of going on. I saw the rock did not extend far, but how to get round it I could not devise. I did not conceive we could get the pinnace round, as the coast seemed surrounded by reefs. Masses of rocks stood up in the sea, and the breakers showed us that more were hidden. After much consideration and many plans, Ernest proposed that we should swim out to the uncovered rocks and endeavor to pass around. Fritz objected, on account of his arms and ammunition, but Ernest suggested that the powder should be secured in the pockets of his clothes, which he might carry on his head, holding his gun above the water. With some difficulty we arranged our encumbrances, and succeeded in reaching the range of outer rocks, without swimming, as the water was not above our shoulders. We rested here a while, and putting on some of our clothes, we commenced our rock over sharp stones, which wounded our feet. In many places, where the rocks lay low, we were up to the waist in the water. Ernest, the proposer of the plan, encouraged us, and led the way for some time, but at last he fell behind, and remained so long, that I became alarmed, and, calling aloud, for I had lost sight of him, he answered me, and at last I discovered him stretched on the rock, endeavouring to separate a piece from it with his knife. "Father," said he, "I am now certain that this bed of rocks, over which we are walking, and which we fancied was formed of stone or flints, is nothing but the work of these remarkable zoophytes called coral insects, which form coral and many other extraordinary things. They can even make whole islands. Look at these little points and hollows, and these stars of every color and every form. I would give all the world to have a specimen of each kind." He succeeded in breaking off a piece, which was of a deep orange color inside. He collected also, and deposited in his bag, some other pieces of various forms and colors. These greatly enriched his collection, and idle as he was, he did not complain of any difficulty in obtaining them. He had given his gun to Jack, who had complained much of the ruggedness of our road. Our march was truly painful, and I repented more than once of having yielded to the idea. Besides the misery of walking along these shelly rocks, which presented points like the sharp teeth of a saw, tearing our shoes and even our skin, the sea in some of the lower places was so high as to bar our passage, and we were obliged, in the interval between two waves, to rush across with the water to our chins. We had some difficulty to avoid being carried away. I trembled especially for Jack. Though small and light, he preferred facing the wave to avoiding it. I was several times obliged to catch hold of him, and narrowly escaped destruction along with him. Happily, our march was not above half a mile, and we gained the shore at last without any serious accident, but much fatigued and footsore, and we made a resolution never more to cross the coral reefs. After dressing ourselves, resting, and taking a slight refreshment on the beach, we resumed our march more at our ease into the interior of the island. But though the long grass was not so sharp as the coral, it was almost as troublesome, twisting round our legs, and threatening to throw us down every step we took. Ernest, loaded with his bag of fragments of rock, coral, and zoophytes, had given his gun to Jack, and fearing an accident among the long grass, I thought it prudent to discharge it. In order to profit by it, I fired at a little quadruped, about the size of a squirrel, and killed it. It appeared to me to be the animal called by naturalists the palm squirrel, because it climbs the cocoa and date palms, hooks itself by its tail, which is very long and flexible, to the upper branches, and feeds at pleasure on the fruit, of which it is very fond. We amused ourselves by details of the habits of this animal, occasionally separating to make more discoveries, but agreeing on a particular call, which was to assemble us when necessary, a precaution by no means useless, as it turned out. Fritz, with his head raised, went on examining all the trees, and occasionally giving a keen look after his gazelle. Ernest, stooping down, examined plants, insects, and occasionally pursuing rare and beautiful butterflies, was filling his bag and plant box with various curiosities. Jack, with his lasso in his hand, prepared himself to fling it round the legs of the first buffalo he met with, and was vexed when he did not see any. For my own part, I was engaged in surveying the chain of rocks, in order to discover that which contained the Grotto Ernestine. It was easy to recognize it, from its summit cleft in two, and I wished to ascertain as nearly as possible if the cleft extended to the base of the rock, as this would render our work much easier. This side of the island did not resemble that near the Great Bay, with which Jack and I had been so much charmed. The island was much narrower here, and instead of the wide plain, crossed by a river, divided by delightful woods, giving an idea of paradise on earth, we were journeying through a contracted valley lying between the rocky wall which divided the island and a chain of sandy hills which hid the sea and sheltered the valley from the wind. Fritz and I ascended one of these hills, on which a few pines and broom were growing, and perceived beyond them a barren tract stretching to the sea, where the coral reefs rose to the level of the water and appeared to extend far into the sea. Any navigators sailing along these shores would pronounce the island inaccessible and entirely barren. This is not the fact. The grass is very thick, and the trees of noble growth. We found many unknown to us, some loaded with fruit. Also, several beautiful shrubs covered with flowers, the dwarf orange tree, the elegant Melaleuca, the nutmeg tree, and the Bengal rose blending its flowers with the fragrant jasmine. I should never finish if I were to try and name all the plants found in this shady valley, which might be called the botanic garden of nature. Ernest was in ecstasies. He wished to carry away everything, but he did not know how to dispose of them. "Ah," said he, "if only our grotto was open on this side." At this moment Fritz came running out of breath, crying out, "The breadfruit tree! I have found the breadfruit tree! Here is the fruit! Excellent, delicious bread! Taste it, father! Here, Ernest, here, Jack!" And he gave each of us a part of an oval fruit, about the size of an ordinary melon, which really seemed very good and nourishing. "There are many of these trees," continued he, "loaded with fruit. Would that we had our grotto opened, that we might collect a store of them now that they are ripe." My boys pointed out to me exactly the situation of the grotto, judging from the rock above, and longed for their tools, that they might commence the opening directly. We proceeded to make our way through a border of trees and bushes that separated us from the rock, that we might examine it and judge of the difficulties of our undertaking. Jack preceded us, as usual, after giving Ernest his gun. Fritz followed him, and suddenly turning to me, said, "I believe kind nature has saved us much trouble. The rock appears to be divided from top to bottom. At the foot I see a sort of cave or grotto already made." At this moment Jack uttered a piercing cry, and came running to us, his lasso in his hand. "Two monstrous beasts!" cried he. "Help! Help!" We rushed forward, our guns ready, and saw at the entrance of the cave two large brown bears. The black bear, whose fur is much valued, is only found in cold and mountainous countries, but the brown prefers the south. It is a carnivorous animal, considered very ferocious. The black bear lives only on vegetables and honey. Of these, the one I judged to be the female seemed much irritated, uttering deep growls and furiously gnashing her teeth. As I knew something of these animals, having met with them in the Alps, I remembered having heard that a sharp whistling terrifies and checks them. I therefore whistled as long and loudly as I could, and immediately saw the female retire backwards into the cave, while the male, raising himself on his hind legs, stood quite still with his paws closed. My two elder sons fired into his breast. He fell down, but being only wounded, turned furiously on us. I fired a third shot at him and finished him. We then hastened to load our guns again, to be ready to receive his companion. Jack wished to use his lasso, but I explained to him that the legs of the bear were too short and thick for such a measure to be successful. He related to us that having entered the cave, he saw something moving at the bottom. He took up a stone and threw it with all his strength at the object. Immediately he heard a frightful growling, and saw two large beasts coming towards him. He had barely time to escape and call for help, and then to hide himself behind a tree. To save ourselves from the other bear, it was necessary that we should take some prompt measures. We therefore advanced and formed a line. Here there is a transcriber's note. Unfortunately, there were two pages unavailable for scanning from the original book, and there is no exact story like this in other editions, so two pages are missing. We will resume our story on chapter 45. End of chapter 45.